Babylon. So if you are a fan of reading your Bible, then hopefully this will help. My goal for today, anyways, is about two-thirds of it. I want to just zing through mostly the Old Testament, but talk about Babylon as a theme or as an archetype of corporate sin, I guess, or what happens when we get together corporately. And then the last third of it is sort of the main point, but what that is how does Jesus address that? And the reason I want to talk about it in general is because sort of big picture, this is just a huge big picture theme anyways. That's why I said if you like to read your Bible, sort of this puts context to a lot of it. But for me, this was something I sort of came to listening to a few podcasts and other things that, you know, Jesus comes and he ministers to the poor, he heals people who are sick, and he casts out demons, and he teaches, and he dies on the cross, and you sort of get that's Jesus, right? That's what he does. For me, they don't always go together, or didn't always go together as a big picture. Not all of those things necessarily felt like they were all on the same mission. They just sort of seem like they're all things that Jesus does, and you grow up knowing that he does all those things, and that's all good. And as I was studying through this theme, this Babylon, I felt like it pulled a lot of that together to me to say, hey, this is a cohesive plan that he has. All these things are intimately tied together, and they all work together to further this one mission that he's going on. So that's what we're going to go over. First off is sort of understanding, I think, how the Bible is written and how Hebrews think about it. And that is that history isn't circular. So it isn't like sort of sometimes you hear in the Eastern cultures where everything goes in a cycle and it all circles around and whatever else. But they do rely heavily on themes or archetypes, right? They tell new stories. Every new story that comes up is put in the context of something that happened before. They tell you these stories intentionally with these themes and these ideas. So for like people, you have Adam as the first man. You've got Moses as this sort of priest leader. You've got David the king. You've got Elijah the prophet. And all of these people are people, and they tell you stories, but they're also like themes. When somebody comes later, when Jesus comes later, they talk about Adam and saying, you know, Adam was this first man, and he had the opportunity to be what we were hoping for, but it didn't quite work out, right? And then they'll talk about Moses as a priest, and there's parts where you're going through the plagues and you're reading, and I don't know if anyone's ever noticed this, but you're reading the plagues, and it actually gets fairly confusing who he's talking about. Is he actually talking about Moses or God? He's sort of like saying, and God said that, put your hands up, and then I put my hands up, and I split the sea, and you're so is that I Moses, or is that I God? And the answer is yes. You know what I mean? At that point, his will was so lined up with God's that it doesn't matter. Whoever was doing it, you know, the whole point is they were like one, right? But Moses isn't quite there either. You know, he had his failings. David, clearly, had his failings. But he also had this heart of God, right? So as you come into the New Testament, you know, a lot of those prophecies and all things are sort of saying, hey, by the way, you have all these people that are so close. And if we could just have that person come that could finish off this cycle, you know? If you could have the Moses without the failings and the Davids without the failings and put it all together in one package, wow, wouldn't that be amazing? Right? So they tell these stories and they introduce new people in terms of old ones. And today was probably the best example because you've got Passover, which is this redemption story that goes through all of the Bible. Like, it's there all the time, right? That God is going to save his people, and he brings it right through. And when Jesus comes, he chooses to do the Last Supper is a Passover meal, right? So he's bringing his redemption story, and he's telling it to you. Hey, by the way, this is the same story that was, you know, way back in Egypt and Exodus and whatever else, right? And one of the good examples to sort of, I guess, help me get around to what they were trying to say was, and this is where it started, I was listening to a bunch of podcasts on the Day of the Lord. And when you say the day of the Lord, most people sort of assume you mean at the end of times. That's sort of a term where the day of the Lord is when, you know, Jesus is going to ride back into town and sort everybody out. So that's the day of the Lord, right? But as you read through the prophets and all the stuff, there's sort of, in the way some people talk about it, is little d days of the Lord before the big D day of the Lord when he comes back and really sorts it up, right? So, but the example that was explaining this, what made my sort of brain click on it, was you got to imagine you're sitting on a mountain range, and the mountain range is stretching out in front of you with mountain, 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 and this big mountain in the back, right? When you're telling the story from that point of view, you're looking at it as they're all mountains, but they're going up to that big mountain, right? So if you're talking about the day of the Lord, whether it's this little day of the Lord that's coming up right today, or whether it's the big end of the Lord at the end of the time, they're sort of looking at it as they're all just mountains. You're like, you can't talk about the first mountain without talking about the mountains, right? And we'll talk about that a little bit, that there were day of the Lord judgments on all kinds of people, even the Israelites, as you were going along. And sometimes, as you're reading through some of these prophets, and this used to kill me, and this is why this is such a good example, was you're reading, and it'll be clearly saying that Babylon is going to fall, right? Babylon's going down, and this is what's going to happen, and comets will come from the sky, and the earth will open up, and fire will come out, So is that when Babylon is gone, or is this the end of time, right? And in their mind, they don't care. To a certain extent, the answer is yes. You know what I mean? They don't differentiate so much that this is a little D day of the Lord and a big D day of the Lord, because this is a theme. God is going to come and judge people who need judging, whether that's a small D. And for them, to a certain extent, it probably was a small D, right? So if God came and judgment came on America, we'd be looking at that as the big D day, right? Because we're here, and we're sort of saying, hey, this is big stuff. This is important. Whereas, I don't know, if you're one of the hundreds of thousands of Christians in Africa, maybe you'd be looking at it as, well, that's a little D day. He dealt with them, but it doesn't really affect us as much, you know what I mean? So it's hard to get around that when you read in the Old Testament, that they're sort of comfortable with that duality, that peace. Because we look at it as, well, this part of the sentence, he must be meaning big D. But then here, over here, when he talks about the army, that's the little D. But then when he goes back to comments, it's big D again. You know what I mean? Because that's just our mindset. That's how we think, right? Everything has to be discreet, exact. That's the way it is. And these people are writing poems, and they're drifting in and out and going all over the place. And we struggle with that in today's world. We really do. So that, to me, is like really important. Right? So, Babylon is what we're going over today. My sort of thoughts, I didn't actually do any slides. I had a few that I was sort of thinking about, but I didn't do any. And this is the only important one, was sort of, what do I mean when I'm going to say Babylon? Or sort of the key points when I look at Babylon. And what I've pulled out, this isn't like exact. I didn't get this from someone smarter than me. So this is just me sort of winging it. But Babylon does not know God. So as you go through, you know, one of the first ones that's sort of raised up in this archetype is Egypt. And the Pharaoh comes right out and says, I don't know this Yahweh God of yours. You know what I mean? But even if they say they kind of do know him, they really don't. You know, they're not following. And it fits into number two and three. Number two is they don't know God's ways, and they don't recognize God's authority, right? So this is Babylon is saying, like, you know, we don't know God's ways. We don't know justice and righteousness. We're not doing that. If you read through the prophets, that's what they're always saying. It's like, you know, you're selling people for the weight of a sandal, or, you know, you're doing all these things that are just unjust. They're just not right. Clearly, you don't know God's ways. And when you're Babylon, you clearly don't know God's authority. Right? That's sort of the whole point. If you want to choose for yourself good and evil corporately. All right? The fourth one is that you use lies, violence, and death as your weapons. So basically sin, right? When you're Babylon, when you are in that place, when you are that corporate evil, and I'll talk about that in just a second too, your weapons are lies, sin, death, violence. That's what you use to accomplish what you want to do. And this is what was so important to me, is when we get to the New Testament, we'll talk about it. When Jesus comes, he says, I can't use the tools of Babylon to defeat Babylon. You can't use lies and violence and death if you really want to defeat this archetype, this model of Babylon, right? And in the early Old Testament, it's not as clear, but as you get through to the New Testament, it makes it very clear that there's a unified evil spirit behind Babylon. There is something that is driving man, when they get together corporately, to evil. Right? So, what I sort of wanted to talk about in general, starting with it anyways, is... if you don't know this about the Bible, you will know. There is a section of Genesis that personally I wish it was just a different book because it would make it much easier. You have chapters 1 through 11 is one section, and then chapter 12 and on is another section, right? And if anybody reads like fiction, like Lord of the Rings or those types of things, when you open the book inside the front cover, it's always got this little map. And it says, like, map of the known world, or something like that, right? That's Genesis chapter 1 through 11. It starts out with just one person. It brings you all the way up. At the end of chapter 11, you've got the 70 nations that exist at that time. They have their languages, they have places, they have everything. And then in chapter 12, God picks his people. Not from among those 70 nations. He picks Abraham and says, the rest of the Bible is about these chosen people, right? 1 to 11 is just setting the stage for the rest of that, right? And what happens is you start in Genesis 1 and you have Adam and Eve, right? They're tempted by a talking snake of all things. Just like weird, right? This evil is just strange and different, and they're tempted to choose to be like God. They see what's good and they take it. They want to be like God. They want to know right and wrong themselves. They want to do this, right? But what a lot of people don't understand is the very next story will build on. So you have Cain and Abel is the next story, right? And then in the next story it says Cain and Abel, God's still talking to them like personally. He's chatting with Cain and Abel. So he's still sort of there with them. But with Cain and Abel, he says, hey, by the way, sin is crouching like an animal waiting to devour you. So it's taking that step from sin exists, it is manipulating you, it's forcing you to do things with Adam and Eve. And then in the next story with Cain and Abel, it says, hey, by the way, this sin is invisible. This is a force that's trying to convince you. It's crouching like a lion, right? It's the next step in that story. And if you go to the next story, it's Lamech. That's Cain's descendant, right? And he starts putting stuff together corporately and starts saying, hey, I'm going to build myself a city. And if you don't know Lamech, he basically brags that someone looked at him the wrong way and he decided to kill him. And then he has the audacity to say, well, if Cain was has some vengeance from God, if he deserved God defending him, then I should deserve even more than that because I'm the best. Exactly. 70 times that, right? So you're sort of like, wow, this guy's a little bit off, right? But then it goes a step further. And I won't go into the rabbit hole of the Nephilim or anything like that. But no matter how you want to interpret the next story, what it is either angels come down or rulers of men say, hey, look, I see these women. This is good. It uses the exact same language as the Adam and Eve. I see what's good, and I take it myself because that's what I want. And it moves up to that corporate level of rulers and, you know, this whole sort of structure is bad, right? So then God says, that's it, we're just wiping it out, right? That's where the flood story comes in chapter 7. And he says, you know what? Back in the very first pages, I put order together. I split the waters. I made land. I made animals. I did all this stuff. And basically with the flood, what I'm going to do is leave you to your own devices and take away all that order. And you actually read the flood story, and it's almost like a reverse creation story. It's like, I'm going to take this away and take that away and take that away until it's all back to chaos. And it goes poorly. Right? So the child version of the ark story is really bad. Because, I mean, one, it's like a horrible story, right? You know, he's like wiping all civilization off the face of the earth, right? And then the end of it as well, usually when you're reading it, you get the nice little, hey, by the way, and I put a rainbow in the sky because I love people and I'm never going to hurt them again, right? What God actually says, if you read that, is, you know what I just realized? you guys are so sinful and so bad that it's just not worth flooding you again. That's honestly what God says in the Bible. He's like, it's in your hearts to have this nature, and me destroying it isn't going to solve that problem. So I'm not going to flood you again, right? So then it moves into his descendants, Noah's descendants. They make the 70 nations. There's a man appropriately named Nimrod that starts the very first city. And guess what the very first city in the Bible is?
Babylon.
Right? He creates Babylon, and then he moves on. He's a great hunter, creates a couple other cities. And then you get to chapter 11, and they build the tower. I never knew this until about 2 months ago. Anyone know the name of that tower? Tower, everybody say Tower of Babel? Yes. You're pretty much all wrong. It's the Tower of Babylon. And for some reason, in the original English translations, they thought it was really cute that they split up the languages and confused the languages. And Babel, languages. So they shortened it to the Tower of Babel. But the Hebrew word is Babylon. So it is Babylon, and they're making a tower in Babylon. And my Bible doesn't actually say that. It says Babylon. And I'm sort of like, really? I didn't know that. I've always heard the Tower of Babel. So the Tower of Babel is actually Babylon. It's the first chance, right? These people get together. It's the only story corporately before God chooses his people. And I'm going to jump into that just a little bit, because obviously this is Babel being created. It's kind of important, right? Not that you get there. So if you want to go along, you can. It's in Genesis chapter 11. You don't necessarily need to if you don't want to, because I'll read it. So, sorry about that. You can't really hide this when you're coughing. In verse 3, it talks about people in Babylon are all getting together. It says they went to a valley. Verse 3, it says, they said to each other, and come, let us make oven-fired bricks. Right? And they used that brick for stone and asphalt for mortar. And then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the sky or heavens, or however that works, right? And it says, let us make a name for ourselves. So some of those things you don't think are that big of a deal. You're just sort of like, all right, we made a tower or whatever else. But some of that is in just the wording and the words themselves, right? When it says, let's make a tower up to the skies, the heavens, that word is basically the lair where God stalks. If you go through their sort of creation, it gets a little bit confusing. But he makes a rakia, he makes a shield over the creation to hold out the waters above, and then God is above that, right? So when it says you're making a tower up to the heavens, it's a pretty clear nod to, hey, we're trying to get up where God is when we do that. And it says, let's make a name for ourselves. In the Bible, naming is incredibly important, right? When you name something, you have authority over it. So when God creates the earth originally, in the first 3 days, he names everything that he's creating, all the big stuff, sun and moon and day and night and light and all of that type of stuff. And then when it comes down to the animals, he says, hey, by the way, I want man to be in charge of the man. I want man basically to be in charge of the earth, to rule on my behalf. You know, you're meant to be sort of middle managers in this model, right? So you're not meant to be peons, which is actually a change from a lot of other cultures at that time. Everybody looked at people were the peons for the gods, right? And in the biblical story, you're actually meant to be important. You're meant to be sort of ruling earth and bringing order on behalf of God that way, right? So therefore, he says, Adam, you go off and name all the animals, because you are in charge of the animals, so you get to name those animals, right? So when they say, when we want to make a name for ourselves, they're not just saying, hey, we just want to be, you know, popular or cool. What they're really saying is, we want to make a name, we're taking control of ourselves here. We want to be in charge when we do this. And we're going to build this tower all the way up to the heavens, right? And it says specifically, otherwise we'll be scattered throughout the earth. And the commandment, the agreement, when Noah says that he's going to flood the earth, when God says he's not going to flood the earth, was, you guys go off, spread out, multiply, and fill the earth. So they're directly sort of going against that, saying, no, 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 we want to stay together, we don't want to spread out, and we want to build a tower up to God, and we want to be bosses of ourselves. Right? And that's what that whole story is saying. So we're going to do all of those things pretty much that you say not to do. And that's the very first sort of corporate story you get in the Bible. Right? And God says, none of that. I'm spreading you all out. I'm giving you your own languages. You're going off and making the 70 nations. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to choose my people. So he selects Abraham as the next step. Right? So that sort of sets up your whole rebellion story, 1 to 11. It's not just Adam and Eve. Everybody likes to think of it that way. It's sort of Adam and Eve talks about the rebellion against God. In reality, there's more to it than that. It sets up a whole, there's personal sin that you get to choose, but there's also what happens when you all get together. And when you all get together, what you do is you make that one. Right? Sadly. And that's that rebellion story. And from then on, Babylon gets used quite often as the term, right? When you go through all the prophets and whatever, they throw that name around a lot. A lot of times it's talking about the actual Babylon, but sometimes it's just throwing that out there as like, yeah, when men get together and they do bad things, that's Babylon. That's what it is, right? That's that story. That's how that all gets together. Right? And guess where Abraham comes from to be picked out of to go and set up somewhere else. It says Ur in the Bible, which is like a stone's throw from Babylon. In Babylonia, the bigger Babylon of the area, right? So he calls out Abraham out of that land and says, I'm going to pick you, my people, and I don't want you near that Babylon story that's going on. Right? All right. So that's sort of setting up a little bit of Babylon, saying where it is. Through the Old Testament, there's a bunch of nations that are used as that Babylon. So one of them, the first one right out of the gate, is Egypt, right? Starts off pretty good. If you know the Bible story, Joseph ends up there and they end up actually saving the people because there's a famine, they have food, all is pretty good. The Bible blips out for about 400 years and comes back and they're slaves. And it's not going well at all, right? And, wink, wink, nod, nod, they're using bricks to have to build for the Egyptians, right? Just like they did in Babylon, but this time that Egypt is using violence and the tools of Babylon to force the Israelites to build their Babylon, right? So you're using these bricks, you're using those same tools that go on, and you have Pharaoh saying, I do not know this Yahweh that you're talking about. That's all nonsense, right? And as you go through that story, the judgment and the Passover that goes with that becomes known as the Day of the Lord. That's the day, right? And the part for me that helped me sort of wrap my head around a lot of this was the next nation that really becomes Babylon as you're going through chronologically is actually Israel, right? Which is sort of mind-blowing. You're like, wait a second, didn't he go off and he pick these people specifically to be his people, right? I picked these people. That's actually jumping ahead, but I'm going to use it because the quote's great. Amos starts off, and he's talking to Israel, the northern kingdom, but he's talking basically to the Hebrews, and he's saying, I have known only you out of all the clans of the earth. And it sort of starts off like, you know, God has this connection with the Hebrews. I know only you throughout all the earth. Therefore, I'm going to punish you for your iniquities. Right? Out of all people, you should know better, and you don't. You know, I've given you the law, I'll walk with you side by side, and you still fall into the same stuff, right? And basically, the whole story is wrapped up in Solomon. So, again, starts off great. If you don't know, David, you know, conquers everywhere, makes the whole nation, everything's going pretty good. He hands off to his son Solomon, and right at the beginning of that story, that whole story's in 1 Kings, it's covered in Chronicles too, but 1 Kings 1 to 11 tells most of the details of Solomon, right? And he chooses to have God give him wisdom, which is sort of like the opposite of that first failing of Adam and Eve. He's saying, you know what, God? I don't want to mess this up. You give me the wisdom of right and wrong and help me, right? So he becomes known for that, and God blesses him. And very quickly, you can see in the story, money starts sort of rolling in. And the interesting thing about it as you're reading it is that the Bible never says, hey, by the way, this is where it goes wrong. It just tells you the story. And you're meant to sort of think this through, and as you're reading it, it sort of comes to you like, hey, wait a second, something's a bit weird here, right? Chapter 5, he starts, and some Bibles are actually kind of kind as you're reading it. He inscripts Hebrews, but if you actually look at the words, the Hebrew words for it, is basically he takes his own people and makes them slaves. He puts slave masters over them, and it's the exact same word as the Egyptian slave masters, and he's using them for the exact same thing. He's sending them off to build his stuff. He inscripts them to build the temple and his palace and whatever. He's sort of like, that's a little bit weird. He's starting to take slaves as he's doing that, right? But it never says he did anything wrong. It says, you know what? He built a palace. He spent 7 years. It was beautiful. You know, it has cypresses. It has this. It has that. The next paragraph, he took 13 years on his own palace. After 7 years on the temple, and he puts in a nice ivory throne with a bunch of steps and cool lions, and he hangs 500 gold shields on the wall as he's doing it. And this one is a cool one. Small detail thrown in there. It says he's got 1,400 chariots, right? And there aren't a lot of details in it, but it gives this one as a very specific. He's got 1,400 chariots with imported Egyptian horses to run the chariots. And you're sort of like, wow, that's pretty flashy, pretty cool, right? He marries the king of Egypt's daughter, and the bride price is actually the king of Egypt destroys the town to give it to him. He ends up with 700 wives, 300 concubines, as he does that, right? So if you don't have to again if you don't want to. I'm flipping to Deuteronomy. It is Deuteronomy 17. All right? 17:16 is the verse. Right? And it talks about if you go into the new land and you choose to have a king, this is what you should do. Right? You can't even make this stuff up, right? You're not to set a foreigner over you or one who's not your people as king, right? However, he must not acquire many horses for himself or send people back to Egypt to acquire many horses. For the Lord has told you, you're never to go back that way again. He must not acquire many wives for himself so his heart won't go astray. He must not acquire very large amounts of silver and gold for himself. When he's on his throne, he should write the scriptures so that he can read them and meditate on them all day. Okay? While he's next to his 510-pound solid gold shields on his five-step ivory throne with the lions on it, he should be reading the scriptures about how he should be just to the poor and the downtrodden. And you start to say, hey, wait a second, this is not good, right? This is all going poorly as he started to get money, as he started to get power, he started to go the way of these people. By the end of that chapter 11, he makes a high place for Chemosh, he reintroduces worship of Ashtoreth, all of those types of things, right? But what that whole story tells you is, That's how Pharaoh became Pharaoh. You know what I mean? He might not have started off with bad intentions. Might not have started as this horribly. But once you start having the money roll in, once you start getting together corporate, you start getting power. That quote, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Right? When all of those tools start together corporately, it's the same as that individual sin. I mean, they're linked. They're the same thing. It's that individual sin within the leader. But you just have to understand, it happens at a personal level and at a corporate level. When you get these things together and make a nation, that's what happens, right? So, he doesn't know God the way he's supposed to. He doesn't have justice. And he ends up using slavery to build his nation. And immediately, when Solomon dies, God judges him and says, hey, by the way, your nation's not going to survive after you now because of that. And immediately when he dies, the next king tries to take over, and because of the slavery, it's split apart. Basically, the people are saying, I was sick of your dad, Solomon. He made us slaves. He made us work. He's taken all of our money, and we're done with that. And the nation splits up. So you end up with Israel in the north, Judah in the south. And there are a whole bunch more Day of the Lord and judgment going on. So basically what happens is, and it gets, there's a whole book on it. I think it's Habakkuk, right? Habakkuk, that talks about, it's a little weird because God raises up these heathen nations to destroy Israel, to mete out his judgment. He's using these evil, bad nations as his tool for judgment on Israel and Judah, which is kind of hard to sort of wrap your hand around, head around, but that's what he does. So he raises up Assyria. Assyria comes in and wipes out Israel. And it's a very sort of contentious time. Assyria falls apart almost immediately. Babylon rises, and Babylon is the one that comes in and takes out final Judah. Right? So there's sort of the final destruction. Not surprisingly. So Babylon is the very first city mentioned. It's the first story that comes in as a corporate sort of evil. It comes around and it also means the end of the Israelite nation by wiping out Judah and the temple. And then you have a couple of books, and that's my next project. Daniel and Esther, that talk about what's it like to live as exiles in Babylon. All right? And that's the language that a lot of the New Testament uses, right? You guys are exiles here. You're in a world that's not your own. How do you live on a daily basis when you're there? And you don't just run away, because Daniel didn't. Daniel was pretty instrumental. He did an awful lot for Babylon. But he had clear lines as well of saying, this is what I'm going to do. You know, my buddies don't bow down to gold Nebuchadnezzar's, and I'm not going to stop praying to God. And there's certain things that he does. But when he's not doing those, he's actually a functioning member of Babylon. So it's a weird struggle that I hope to study.
John, is this the same Babylon that was the first city?
Yep.
Never.
Very same city, and it basically swapped hands a bunch of times, and then it returned. If you're reading in the Bible, a lot of times it says Chaldeans or Chaldeans. I don't know if you want to say that. Chaldeans, that's Babylon. It's like a synonym, basically. Same thing. But yes, so it's the same place that goes around. And works up. And completely, to a certain extent, nothing to do with anything, but I thought it was crazy as I was reading this, right? Nineveh is the capital of Assyria. That's where Jonah goes, and it's like very well known as this bad city, right? But it's at one point the capital of the largest nation, right? And Nahum says, he pronounces this judgment on him, and he doesn't quite say it in perfect words, but he pretty much sort of says, you're going to be wiped out. Like you're going to disappear from the map, and that's what's going to happen. And as I was reading this, it turns out that Nineveh gets burned and razed when Babylon comes up. And within 200 years, there's a story of an army marching through, and they didn't even fully realize they were in a city, and they definitely did not know it was Nineveh, and it disappeared again until the 1850s, when they finally realized, hey, this is where Nineveh is. So can you imagine a massive city that's the center of the known world gets wiped out to the point within a couple hundred years, it's just gone. It's like if no one even knew it was there. It just disappeared off the face of the map. So I just thought that was good. Don't get on the bad side of prophets. Alright. And then that gets you through the Old Testament. You start with Babylon, you end with Babylon. Right? In the New Testament, it does make a few references to Babylon. A lot of times they call Rome Babylon as they're going through. But Revelation is the next place that really covers it. So I'm going to go to Revelation 17:1. Right at the beginning of chapter 17, hopefully most of you know John is writing this revelation. He's trying to let you behind the curtain. That's what that actually means. Apocalypse doesn't necessarily mean the end of the world. We sort of take it that way. But what it really means is I'm letting you behind the curtain to see what's really going on. I'm giving you insight to some of this stuff that you can't see in your daily life. These battles that are going on behind the scenes, right? So 17:1 says, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me. Come, I'll show you judgment on the notorious prostitute who's seated on many waters. The kings of the earth committed immorality with her, and those who live on the earth became drunk on the wine of her immorality. Then he carried me away to the spirit, in the spirit, to a wilderness. And that's where I was jumping to. This is in verse 3. I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, jewels, and pearls. She had a golden cup in her hand filled with everything detestable and with the impurities of her prostitution. Right? So he's sort of laying it out at the beginning. This is looking really great. She's got pearls and fancy clothes and everything that the world would want. Right? And in her cup were all the detestable impurities. And on her forehead was written a name, a mystery: Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the detestable things of the earth. And I saw the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses to Jesus. Right? So clearly that just sort of sets you up saying it's got all of the things that today's world would want. Your jewels and your everything, right? But clearly Babylon is meant to be this image of when all of that goes wrong, right? And I didn't necessarily expect in any way to make this political or connected to what's going on today, because I just want to get to the Jesus piece, which is not necessarily relevant to that. But as you're reading through, you are starting to look at, you know, what's available on the internet today and how it's destroying our young children and their relationships, and how just everything is about lies now. You just sort of, you can't help but sort of look through this. It jumps to chapter 18, verse 2, and it said, there's a judgment coming from an angel. He called out in a mighty voice, "It has fallen. Babylon the Great has fallen. She's become a home for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, and for every unclean and despicable beast." And it goes on and sort of says, basically, people indulge. You went along with this Babylon, and you just got dragged down with it. Right? So that's what all of this is when they use the term Babylon and this sort of corporate thing. So what the piece that I wanted to talk about quick, and I'm not going to go on like 12 hours more, the point of this is actually shorter than the build-up, if that makes sense. How does Jesus war and eventually defeat Babylon? Right? So like I was saying at the beginning, he comes and he comforts the poor, he heals the sick, casts out demons, teaches the word, dies on the cross. How does that all fit together? Right? How does that all come together? And if you think about what I was laying out before, what is Babylon? What is it that we're fighting against? And it says, does Jesus personally live out and also teach us to know God? Right? The most amazing part of the New Testament is you don't have to go through the priests. You don't have to go through anything. You can have a direct personal relationship with God now because of Jesus. Because of his coming and his laying it out, you can actually have a direct line to God. Right? Knowing God's ways. He comforts the poor. He heals the sick, the downtrodden. He gets God's ways, right? He understands them. And then he goes around and teaches. That's a big piece of his mission, saying, hey, look, what are God's ways? This is what God expects. This is what you have available to you with God. This is what's going on, right? He recognizes God's authority all the way to the point of his own death. Let's talk about that a little bit. But clearly he recognizes that authority. And this, for me, was the big piece that sort of puts it all together, is he refuses to use lies and violence and death to win. So he does not use all the tools of Babylon to defeat Babylon. Right? So all of the Hebrews are coming saying, where is this king? Where is he? He's going to come in. He's going to, you know, sort everything out. He's going to do it. And what Jesus is saying is, I am that warrior king. A lot of people like to think, you know, the warrior piece, like there's a lot in the Old Testament that talks about salvation in terms of warrior stuff, right? Like right after the Exodus, there's a big long poem saying, our salvation is going to come as a warrior, right? He's going to come in and clean house. He's going to do this. And it's kind of hard to put Jesus in that warrior mindset. Like, he doesn't seem like a warrior, right? He doesn't. But he does. He's just not fighting physical nations. He's fighting Babylon. He's coming in. He's casting out demons. He's refusing to use the weapons of Babylon to fight against Babylon. Because if he does, he's just going to create another Babylon. If he comes in and he just wipes out Rome or whoever it is and makes a new nation, what's going to happen? Right? You're going to end up with Babylon again. Right? So how do you defeat the weapons of Babylon? You take away the sting of sin, of death itself. Right? So now Babylon's weapons have no hold on us if we want to be in God's kingdom.
Amen.
Because he's defeated those weapons. Right? He came without using the weapons of Babylon, and basically by the end of this whole story, Babylon's weapons don't work anymore. They're not available to you if you want to be part of his kingdom. Right? And he did that by, last one, actively attacking that unified spirit of evil that comes behind Babylon and leads to that. Right? So that's who he's defeating. That's who he's attacking with all these things. And all of these pieces of him healing the sick and teaching and dying on the cross, it all fits together to say, this is who he's really fighting. He's fighting those weapons of Babylon, but he can't do it in the usual way. And that's what killed the Jews, the Hebrews, is they wanted him to come in and just take these weapons that I'm used to using and sort these people out. But Jesus knows you can't do that, right? So, the one quick piece I'm going to go to in the New Testament is Matthew. So, if you read all three of the Gospels, start off right at the beginning with Jesus being tempted in the wilderness. So in Matthew, that happens in 4. And basically what happens at the end of 3, Jesus is coming to start his ministry. He is getting baptized by John at the end of chapter 3 in Matthew. And the very last verse is verse 17, chapter 3, 17. And it said, "And a voice from heaven said, 'This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased.'" Right? So Jesus comes along, he gets baptized, he's going to start his mission, right? The next sentence, chapter 4, "Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil." The very first thing that happens, right? You're going to start off your ministry? Well, if this is going to be your ministry, you might as well start here, right? And he's going in to tempt the devil. It's not even necessarily his choice. It's sort of saying, hey, this is where you're going. You're being led there. That's what's going to happen. Right? So, a lot of parallels to the Old Testament in the wilderness. I won't go into those, but there are a lot. So, he fasted for 40 days and 40 nights, and he was very hungry. Right? Verse 3 says, "And the tempter approached and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, then tell these stones to become bread.'" Right? The last sentence before was God saying, "Hey, by the way, this is my Son, whom I'm well pleased." So then Satan comes along and he's like, "Oh, so you're the Son of God. If you're really the Son of God, then turn these stones into bread." Right? So what he's saying is, if you've really got this power, you've got all the power that you could really want, why don't you use it to benefit yourself? Just like Solomon, just like all those other kings that have power. It's just so easy. You could just do that. And you could, why submit to God's authority and be hungry after 40, can you imagine 40 days of being hungry? I mean, that's serious hunger. Right? So that is, yeah, there's a bunch of hunger strikers in Ireland, and they all sort of died in and around that frame. You can get like 30 to 50 days without starving to death entirely, somewhere in that region. So he's like at the point of death from starvation. And they're saying, "You've got the power. All you got to do is just be like some, just be like everybody else that uses that power for their own good." And Jesus says, "No, not going to happen," right? Interestingly, those same words, "If you are the Son of God, just do this," show up one more time in the book of Matthew. In 27:40, when he is on the cross, people walk by and they're like, "If you're really the Son of God, why don't you just come down off that cross?" Right? So right at the point where he's going through the worst sacrifice in the Old Testament, Satan's words come right back to him. You can just get out of this if you want. You got the power. Right? That's the tempter coming right for Jesus, saying, this is what's happened to all men through time. Right? Like that Rolling Stones song. Doesn't change, right? The tempter is sitting right there saying, you can just come off that cross if you want to. The exact same words coming back to him, right? So then comes down to verse 5, and it says, the devil took him to the holy city, standing on the pinnacle of the temple, and said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it's written, he will give his angels orders concerning you, and they'll support you with their hands, so that you would not strike your foot against a stone. Right? So he's saying, toss yourself off, right? What he's really doing there is, why don't you just get God to work on your behalf, right? Turn the table so this is on your terms rather than God's terms, right? But what it's appealing to is rather than the hunger, they sort of turn it over to the pride, right? This is where you could have your chance, right? Don't, like, you could be the one to just jump off there and God himself would have to come and do your bit, really, to try and save you. So, instead of those sort of material concerns. And then you get to the third one, it says, again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. And he said to him, I'll give you all these things if you just fall down and worship me. Right? He's basically saying, you could accomplish your whole mission without all that suffering, without all that hassle and everything. You could do what you want to do if you just make a deal with Babylon. Right? If you're just willing to make that little deal, you can avoid all of this and just jump right to the end. Isn't that what you're hoping for? Right? So by this point, Jesus had enough, and he says, go away, Satan, or get behind me, Satan, depending on your translation. Right? For it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve only him. Again, interestingly enough, that one phrase comes back again later. And it's just before he goes to the cross. He's telling the disciples this is what's going to happen. He's talking to Peter in verse 16, chapter 16, verse 23. And Peter says, that doesn't have to happen to you, God. You don't have to go to the cross. You know, we'll lay our lives down for you. We'll fight. We'll take it to them. We'll use the weapons of Babylon to sort all this out. And Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. Just as he said right there, right? It's the same question. It's the same story. Are you willing to use these powers of Babylon? Are you willing to make a deal with the devil himself to use his weapons to sort this out rather than suffer the way God has intended? Rather than follow his authority, are you willing to do that? Right? So, Jesus submits to God's ways and authority. He refuses to use his power for personal gain. He refuses sin, pride, lies, violence, death. And he defeats all of those weapons of Babylon for us. Right? So when you say, where, O death, is your sting? He's taken away all the weapons of Babylon. He's taken away all the weapons of what can hold you back, if you are willing to take that on. Right? And for me, that just put together a whole big picture of things. So I'm like, all right, I kind of get it a little more now. You know, the way he's healing, the way he's teaching, just his actions. And as you're reading it sometimes, I'm like, oh, I've read that before. But now it just sort of has a new swing to it. Like, he is actively attacking Babylon, right? He's coming as that savior. He's head of an army. But he just refuses to use the weapons of Babylon to accomplish that and to accomplish his goals, right? So, that was a true victory on the cross. I would question for you, in today's world, it is so easy to be pulled into the weapons of Babylon. Right? So where are you personally using, not just believing? We talk a lot about it in this church, saying, you know, there's lots of lies out there and you all have to know the truth. And there's lots of lies, you got to know the truth and all that type of stuff. Are you using lies in your interactions with people? And it's easy to, Because in today's world, everything is polarized. Everything is one side or the other. And sometimes people are tempted to just use lies for a good purpose, right? I'm trying to get to a good goal. And I'm willing to stretch the truth or ignore the truth for my good goal of God's kingdom, right? I'm going to ignore this truth because I think it fits my agenda to be on the right side. But you can't. You can't use those weapons of Babylon, right? You can't respond in anger when people do use those weapons against you because you're using the weapons of Babylon. It's not going to further the kingdom of God, right? That's a hard one, right? That what Red was talking about earlier is, are you not so much using violence and death, but are you using the fear of that to keep you back? Is the fear of the kingdom of Babylon keeping you from doing what you should be doing? If that's the case, then you're a slave to Babylon. Right? If it's keeping you from speaking the truth, living the truth, from avoiding a sinful lifestyle, then you're allying yourself with Babylon. You're allying yourself with the enemy because of that fear of reprisal. It may or may not be physical violence, but you guys all know it's violence. You know, whether it's physical or verbal or whatever it is, this world is not going to be happy a lot of times when you come out and speak the truth. So that is a challenge for you in your personal life to sort of try to say, hey, how do I address that stuff? Why is it? But I think for me it was helpful just to put all of it in a big picture context to say, hey, all of these things kind of fit together. Why is it that God says you can't sin? Why does he go around casting out demons? All of these things fall into this, you know, unified evil of Babylon. You can't sin because when you do, you become part of what you fight against. You're using their very weapons when you sin in order to do that. So he's provided a way not to fall into that trap of sin, but you have to take him up on that. Thank you, Father God, for your word. It is sharper than any sword. And we need that more now today than ever before, God. Please use it to enlighten us. Use us as your tools in this fight against Babylon. Help us to know how to live as exiles in this world and be faithful servants to you every day. In Jesus' name, amen.
Really good. Really good. Really, really makes you think, doesn't it?